Hello and welcome to Sound Body, a weekly program of information on health topics and ideas that can help you live life to its fullest. I'm Louise Craig. For more than 30 years, the University of California at Berkeley has been publishing a wellness letter. In it, researchers, doctors, and wellness experts from the School of Public Health at UC Berkeley and elsewhere report on the best studies and information available to promote optimal physical and mental well-being. They have published a year-in-review compendium of the best wellness letters from 2017. While the topics covered in this annual compilation range from arthritis to compression socks, bacon diabetes, electronic cigarettes, toenail fungus, and telemedicine, all of the pieces included are meant to give you reliable information to promote and protect your health. I'm not sure which articles we will read, but I can guarantee a wide variety today. We start with Healthy Blood Pressure, Healthy Brain. And this comes from the January 2017 wellness letter. High blood pressure, hypertension, especially in middle age, is a major contributor to cognitive decline and dementia later in life, according to a new scientific statement from the American Heart Association published in the journal Hypertension. Its review of the research explains how hypertension can cause brain diseases such as stroke, vascular cognitive impairment, and dementia, including Alzheimer's disease, and it highlights what is still not completely understood. Vascular cognitive impairment involves a range of changes in brain function, from mild to severe, caused in part by impaired blood flow to the brain. The brain and its blood vessels are main targets for hypertension's adverse effects, including oxidative stress, damage to white matter, brain atrophy, and strokes, microscopic or full-blown. Strokes, in turn, increase the risk of cognitive impairment and dementia. Hypertension is the most powerful modifiable risk factor for the cerebrovascular damage and the dramatic reduction in stroke mortality over the past several decades has been attributed to the treatment of hypertension, according to the authors. But while many clinical trials have shown that treatment of hypertension, usually with drugs, reduces the risk of strokes and other cardiovascular disease, the evidence supporting its beneficial effect on cognitive health has been largely observational and has not been able to prove cause and effect. One complication is that it can take decades for hypertension to cause cognitive problems, and clinical trials lasting that long are a difficult undertaking. Although robust evidence is lacking to prove that antihypertensive therapy in middle age provides a cognitive benefit, such a benefit appears likely, the authors stated. Given how prevalent hypertension is, and that there are many accessible and effective drugs, treatment of hypertension may prove to be one of the best ways to prevent or delay dementia. The following questions remain unanswered. When is the optimal time to begin treating rising blood pressure in order to protect cognition, perhaps while it's still in the hypertension range, and how aggressive should the treatment be? When people have both hypertension and advanced cognitive impairment, will treating the former reverse the latter or at least slow its progression? How does hypertension interact with various genetic and neurodegenerative factors in the brain? Do specific classes of antihypertensive drugs confer greater cognitive benefits than others? An invisible threat. Carbon monoxide is one of the leading causes of accidental poison-related death in the U.S., killing more than 400 people a year and sending at least 50,000 to the emergency room, according to the CDC. That doesn't include the many deaths from carbon monoxide that are suicides. The risk rises during the fall and winter months when people fire up their furnaces, as well as after natural disasters when power outages may necessitate the use of portable generators. This colorless, odorless gas is a byproduct of combustion from burning fuels such as oil, gas, propane, wood, and charcoal. Cars, trucks, gas or charcoal grills, gas-powered tools, gas ranges, gas-powered generators, heating systems, fireplaces, and wood-burning stoves all produce carbon monoxide. The gas becomes dangerous when it builds up in enclosed spaces, such as a house, garage, car, boat, or RV, due to inadequate ventilation. For example, heating systems are designed to send fumes outside, but if the systems are not maintained or checked regularly, blockages may occur, sending the fumes back into the building or home. The gas can also accumulate if you burn wood or charcoal indoors or run an engine in the garage with the door closed. As you breathe in carbon monoxide, it starts to bind to hemoglobin in the blood, greatly decreasing its oxygen-carrying capacity. This can trigger symptoms including shortness of breath, nausea, dizziness, lightheadedness, and headaches. The signs and symptoms can be subtle and mimic those of other illnesses. If you are sleeping or have been drinking alcohol heavily, you could die of carbon monoxide poisoning without ever noticing the symptoms. The key is prevention. Install a carbon monoxide alarm. Make sure appliances are installed and vented properly. The CDC recommends that a qualified technician service your heating system, water heater, and all gas, oil, or coal-burning appliances once a year. Never use a gas oven or range to heat your home. Use generators, charcoal grills, camp stoves, and other gas or charcoal-burning devices outside only, at least 20 feet from windows, doors, and vents. Never leave your car's motor running when it is in the garage, even with the garage door open. The odorless fumes can quickly fill the garage and seep into the attached house. When warming up the car outdoors, make sure the exhaust pipe is not blocked by snow. If you suspect carbon monoxide poisoning, get fresh air immediately by going outdoors or to a well-ventilated area. Then call 911. It's important that your level of exposure be quickly assessed and that you receive the appropriate treatment right away at a hospital emergency department. Buying an alarm. Every home should have carbon monoxide alarms. In some states and localities, this is mandatory. These potentially life-saving devices usually cost less than $50 and are relatively easy to install. There are two main types, battery-powered and those connected to a home's electrical system. Battery-powered units will work during a power outage, but you must remember to change the batteries every 6 months. A good way to remember? Do it when you change your clocks each spring and fall. Alarms that run on a home's electricity can either plug into existing power outlets or be hardwired into the electrical system by an electrician. Both kinds come with a battery backup in case the power goes out. Whichever type you choose, make sure it meets standard UL2034 of the Underwriters Laboratory. The label will have this information. Follow the manufacturer's installation instructions, which include not placing them near heat or combustion sources, and replace them every 5 years. If one starts ringing, go outside and call 911 immediately. Some battery-operated alarms begin to chirp to alert you if the power is low, but continuous ringing from a properly installed device indicates an unsafe level of carbon monoxide. Golden years. Two studies published over the past year offer insights into the potential health effects of retirement. Retirement can provide a window of opportunity for positive behavioral changes, according to an Australian study in the Journal of Preventive Medicine. It involved more than 27,000 people, ages 45 and older, 31 of whom retired over the study's three-year period. 3,100 of whom retired over the study's three-year period. The retirees reported increased physical activity, decreased sedentary time, and slightly more sleep. Among women, the odds of continuing to smoke were also reduced. Previous research suggests, however, that such changes may depend on a retiree's circumstances and the type of job previously held. For instance, people who have to retire because of illness or injury, or to take care of a family member, may be less likely to make beneficial lifestyle changes. And some people with physically demanding jobs may end up being less active in retirement. Taking part in social groups after retirement is linked to longer life, according to an English study in BMJ Open. Researchers followed 424 people during the 6 years after they retired and found that the more memberships to clubs, organizations, or societies they maintained, the better their quality of life and the less likely they were to die. Age, health, and other factors were controlled for. Vigorous exercise was also associated with lower death rates. Conversely, giving up exercise after retirement was linked to higher death rates. This suggests that group memberships have a distinct role to play in the process of adapting to new circumstances following retirement and have effects that are comparable in size to those of physical activity, the researchers concluded. And we will move on to Ask the Experts. This comes at the end of every wellness letter. Question: I often get red, itchy, swollen eyelids. What can I do to relieve this? Answer: this sounds like blepharitis, though if symptoms last more than 2 weeks or are particularly bothersome, you should see an eye doctor for evaluation. If it is blepharitis, you may also experience crusting around the eyelashes, excessive tearing of the eyes, and a burning sensation. Blepharitis can affect the front of the eyelid where the eyelashes are attached. The two most common causes of this are bacteria and seborrheic dermatitis, like scalp dandruff, but on the eyelids. It can also affect the inner eyelid when the oil glands located around the base of the lashes become clogged and accumulate debris. Blepharitis is also frequently associated with acne rosacea, which causes red and inflamed skin, and dry eye syndrome. Some people develop hordeola, painful lumps near or on the edge of the eyelid, commonly known as styes, in conjunction with blepharitis. Though blepharitis can clear up on its own, it often becomes a chronic condition that requires daily care for life. However, while it may be uncomfortable, it rarely has serious medical consequences and is not contagious. Home treatment involves keeping the lids clean and free of crusts. Using a clean washcloth, place compresses soaked in warm water over your eyes for several minutes, several times a day, to loosen the crusts. Then lightly scrub the eyelids using a mixture of water and a few drops of baby shampoo placed on a cloth or cotton swab. Commercial eyelid scrubs are also available. Follow with a lid massage using either a washcloth or a clean fingertip. Gently massage your lids using circular motions to clear the oil accumulated in the glands. Don't wear eye makeup or contact lenses until the symptoms clear. If scalp dandruff is present, a dandruff shampoo for the hair is recommended, as well to prevent the debris from falling into the eyes and causing a further reaction and clogging of the glands. If self-care measures don't help enough, your doctor may prescribe antibiotics or steroid eye drops. Topical antibiotic ointments can be applied on the eyelid edges for a few weeks. Oral antibiotics may be needed for more difficult-to-manage cases, such as in people with rosacea. Question: are Canadian bacon and turkey bacon healthier choices than regular bacon? Answer: they have significantly fewer calories and less fat than regular bacon, but they're not better in all ways, which is why you should limit how much you eat of any type of bacon. American-style bacon is made from pork belly meat and is highest in calories, 120 to 150, fat, 10 to 12 grams, much of which is saturated, and sodium, 300 to 600 milligrams per ounce uncooked. Keep in mind that bacon varies widely in terms of calories, fat, and sodium depending on the brand, cut of meat, and how it is prepared. When bacon is heated, a fair amount of its fat cooks off, so that a well-cooked strip may have only half the calories of an uncooked slice, assuming the grease is not consumed. In contrast, Canadian bacon, also known as English, Irish, or back or pea-meal bacon, is typically made from leaner pork loin and is more like ham, with about 30 calories, less than 1 gram of fat, and about 200 milligrams of sodium per ounce uncooked. Turkey bacon, which is made from ground dark and light turkey meat, may sound like it would be healthier than any type of pork bacon, but it has more calories, 65 per ounce, and fat, 5 grams, than Canadian bacon, and is also high in sodium, 300 milligrams. Still, it's a better choice than regular bacon. To lower the fat and calories, cook bacon on a grill, indoor or outdoor, or on a rack in a pan in the oven, which allows the fat to drip off. Don't pan fry it or add more fat or oil in cooking. For further reductions, blot the bacon on a paper towel after cooking. Another issue with all cured bacon is that such processed meats were classified by the International Agency for Research on Cancer in 2015 as carcinogenic to humans, based on observational studies linking them to colorectal and other cancers, possibly due to their nitrate and nitrite preservatives. Though it has not been clearly established that processed meats cause cancer, observational studies do not prove cause and effect, it's still a good idea to limit them, since there's strong evidence linking them to cardiovascular disease and other disorders. What about veggie bacon? Typically made from textured vegetable protein and wheat gluten, along with a long list of additives, these highly processed products can be just as high in calories and sodium as regular bacon and lower in protein. One brand is 105 calories, 8 grams of fat, and 200 milligrams of sodium per ounce. Though much of the fat comes from healthier vegetable fat, go easy on this bacon, too. Wellness made easy. Trying to lose weight, making lunch your main meal may help more than eating the most calories at dinner, suggests an Iranian study recently in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. 69 healthy, overweight, or moderately obese women took part in a sensible clinical-based weight loss program. Half were told to make lunch their biggest meal, the other half dinner. They chose their own food, but got guidance from nutritionists and were encouraged to exercise. Though there were no significant differences in their calorie or macronutrient intakes, after 12 weeks, the lunch group lost 3 pounds more on average than the dinner group, 9.5 versus 12.5 pounds, and had greater improvement in insulin sensitivity. Longer-term research is needed to determine if these results can be maintained and generalized. Speaking of wellness, and this is from the chair of the editorial board of the Wellness Letter, John Swartzberg, MD, are you pre-sick? Are too many Americans being diagnosed with pre-diseases? In recent years, millions have gotten such a diagnosis, but the vast majority of people with the following conditions don't know they have them. Pre-hypertension. The CDC estimates that one-third of American adults, about 75 million, have this condition, defined as blood pressure levels between 120 over 80 and 140 over 90. That is, higher than normal, but not yet in the hypertension range. Another one-third of adults have full-blown hypertension. People with prehypertension are at elevated risk for stroke. Prediabetes. Similarly, the CDC estimates that slightly more than one-third of adults, 86 million, have fasting blood glucose levels between 100 and 125. Higher than normal, but below the diabetic range. Without lifestyle changes, 15 to 30% of them will develop type 2 diabetes within 5 years. Dyslipidemia. That's the medical term for undesirable blood levels of lipids, that is, cholesterol and triglycerides. Though not officially a pre-disease, dyslipidemia increases the risk of heart disease, including heart attacks. The CDC estimates that about one-third of adults have high LDL or bad cholesterol. Osteopenia. This is characterized by moderate bone loss, but not enough to be considered osteoporosis. It's estimated that nearly half of women over age 50 and perhaps 30% of men over 50 have osteopenia of the hip, which puts them at elevated risk for hip fractures. Keep in mind that the line between good health and disease is often blurry. The exact cutoffs for key markers, say a fasting blood glucose level of 125 for diabetes, are derived from data on large populations, are somewhat arbitrary, and have been much debated. And now, instead of a line between good health and disease, we often have a large gray area called a pre-disease with equally murky endpoints. Does it make sense to tell so many people they are, in effect, pre-sick? Is it any wonder that some of them suspect this is largely a strategy by the pharmaceutical industry to sell more drugs? The biggest risk posed by pre-diseases is that they often progress to the full-fledged diseases unless people take preventive steps. But some pre-diseases, like pre-diabetes, pose health risks themselves, albeit less than the diseases. Despite the uncertainties, I believe it's very worthwhile to call attention to pre-diseases, which should serve as a wake-up call. If you know your blood pressure is inching upward, you can take steps to control it, such as consuming less sodium and losing excess weight. The same is true with pre-diabetes, undesirable cholesterol readings, and, to a lesser extent, low bone mineral density. Clearly, it's far better to treat pre-diseases via lifestyle changes, notably diet and exercise, than to take medication with potential side effects. There's good evidence, for instance, that an intensive lifestyle program can help prevent diabetes in many people with pre-diabetes. See tinyurl.com/diabetes, capital W, capital L. Current guidelines for the treatment of dyslipidemia emphasize the importance of making lifestyle changes before starting statin therapy, though often this is not stressed enough to patients. When lifestyle changes don't help enough despite repeated efforts, then drugs may be an option, depending on the pre-disease. Statin therapy is a proven risk reducer in people with undesirable lipid levels and other coronary risk factors. Drug treatment for pre-diabetes and pre-hypertension should be limited to only certain groups. Despite drug industry marketing a decade ago, bone-building drugs are rarely prescribed for osteopenia. Also, wellness made easy, if you take medication for osteoporosis, it's still important to maintain bone-healthy lifestyle habits. While such drugs decrease fractures, they do not eliminate all risk, as was reported in a study in the journal Bone of more than 7,400 women ages 50 and older who were on oral bisphosphonates, the most common osteoporosis treatment, for at least 2 years. Despite treatment, about one-third remained at elevated risk for future osteoporotic fractures because their bone density didn't improve or even worsened, or they had suffered fractures while taking the drugs. Lifestyle measures include not smoking, doing weight-bearing exercises, getting recommended amounts of calcium, which is 1,200 milligrams a day for women over 50 and men over 65, and vitamin D, 600 to 800 IU a day, though many experts recommend 800 to 1,000 IU or more. And taking steps to decrease falls, such as removing obstacles and improving lighting at home and using canes or other assistive devices when needed. If you have asthma, a vitamin D supplement taken along with standard medication may help prevent attacks, according to a new Cochrane review, which looked at 9 clinical trials involving children or adults, most with mild to moderate disease. It found not only that people who took the supplements had fewer asthma attacks than those taking a placebo, but also that they were one-third less likely to have an attack requiring steroid medication and two-thirds less likely to have an attack requiring a trip to the hospital. However, vitamin D was not associated with improved lung function or day-to-day symptoms. It's not known what dose is optimal. Dosage ranged from 400 to 4,000 IU a day or 60,000 IU a month in the studies. nor how baseline vitamin D status affected the results. Moreover, the benefits were seen mainly in adults, so more research is needed, particularly involving children with asthma. Herbal remedies and other dietary supplements can harm the liver, according to a new review based on reports to the NIH's Drug-Induced Liver Injury Network, published in Hepatology. The proportion of all drug-related liver injuries that could be attributed to supplements rose from 7% in 2004 to about 20% in 2014. Bodybuilding formulas, notably those spiked with illegal anabolic steroids, and weight loss products, notably those containing green tea extract, accounted for about half of the cases of liver damage linked to supplements. Many of the supplements contained multiple ingredients, so it's often impossible to identify the cause of liver damage. And I know it's hard to hear this while it's so hot outside, but winter will return. And to avoid slipping on icy or otherwise slick streets, try adapting a new walking gait. Bend slightly at the waist so that your center of gravity falls over your feet, and slowly take short, flat-footed steps, in effect shuffling a little like a penguin. Keep your arms free for balance. You can even extend them out to the sides as you walk for more steadiness. Wear gloves so you're less inclined to put your hands in your pockets. That way your hands and forearms will be free to help break a fall if necessary. And wear shoes that have good traction, not slippery soles. Be aware that you can't always see ice on streets or road. That's what's called black ice or clear ice. Rather, the surface may simply look wet or black. A healthy lifestyle greatly reduces the risk of coronary artery disease, even in people who are genetically prone to it, according to an analysis in the New England Journal of Medicine. Using data from four large observational studies, researchers correlated a genetic score and lifestyle score for more than 55,000 people. They found that while the worst genetic scores can double the risk of heart attacks or other coronary events, a healthy lifestyle score, meaning at least three of these factors, no smoking, no obesity, regular exercise, and healthy diet, appeared to nearly counteract that risk. And that's where we need to leave it. Thank you for tuning in to Sound Body. Stay well. Come back next week for more healthy living ideas. This has been Sound Body, a production of WXXI Reach Out Radio in Rochester, New York. I'm Louise Craig, and I hope you'll join me again next week for more health updates and information for healthy living. If you'd like to hear this program again, you can download a podcast of the show at our website, wxxi.org.